The beauty of these satellite platforms is they're very, the data are freely available. They give you large spatial coverage, decent temporal coverage. The next steps in that is, in my stuff I've been working on kind of in the back burner for years now, is combining those data with process-based models. And so we can really look at the fundamentals of how these ecosystems intercept light and convert that into biomass, and use that as a way to generate this understanding at this larger scale that can hopefully help both inform management decisions as well as plug into some of the ecosystem service discussion and outcome models. So what are the impacts on the carbon cycle, the water cycle, for watershed recharge and all that stuff.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. My name is Brian Arnell, and I'm coming to you from Oklahoma State University. This show is brought to you on behalf of Wyzenetics. Today, I'm happy to have with us Dr. Chris Wilson. Chris is Assistant Professor of Forages, Global Change Ecologist, University of Florida. As an agroecologist, Dr. Wilson brings concepts, methods, and data from ecological science to the design, management, and study of agricultural systems, including annual crops and pastures. He's got a diverse research team with three really broad research objectives. One, how to monitor agroecosystems productivity and contribution to agroecosystems using data from satellite imageries, remote sensing, hyperspectral sensors, ecosystem model, and Bayesian inference, which shockingly enough is an agronomist. I know what Bayesian is. Studying how pasture management, including plant composition, diversity, and nutrient application and grazing impacts productivity above ground and below ground. And then finally, investigating how exposure to abiotic stressors like drought can impact crop physiology, plant defenses, with the goal of designing a more resilient crop production system. Chris, after all that, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
I don't know. Share with our audience a little bit about, how did you end up in this field and at University of Florida?
Yeah. So it's, I think like a lot of people's life journey is kind of a circuitous path. I actually grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I was kind of a city kid, always very environmentally minded. And my mother was always very active in gardening. And I kind of caught that plant bug from her when I was in high school. And around that time, I also went to, there was a public lecture from a kind of famous agroecologist, John Vandermeer, at the University of Michigan. And he was talking about all kinds of stuff, linking, ecosystem diversity to agricultural practices, talking a lot about Cuba and a bunch of stuff I had never heard before. And I thought that was pretty fascinating. I hadn't realized that you could really use ecosystem sciences to study agriculture. I mean, in my mind, these were totally different things. I ended up going to undergraduate at the New College of Florida down in Sarasota, formerly obscure liberal arts college. And we had a lot of kind of curricular flexibility to kind of shape our path. So I studied a mix of ecology, biology, applied mathematics, and then as often as I could, I would sneak in like independent studies, or we would put together like these small courses that were kind of agriculturally themed. We had a pretty active campus garden at the time that was just kind of student led that I got involved in. And so I just kind of continued that focus. And so I ended up doing my senior thesis there, looking at how landscape structure impacts pest regulation in farm systems. And I actually did like a little field experiment at a local like CSA style vegetable farm, trying to intentionally add floral diversity to attract predators and parasitoids of pests that they had. Like everybody's first field experiment, a whole bunch of stuff went wrong and the data were kind of unusable. But it did kind of get me hooked a bit on this idea of doing science in agricultural systems you know, with the goal of designing for sustainability. And so after undergrad, my now wife and I both did an internship at the Archbold Biological Station, which is a really cool field ecology station in South Florida. They have a branch that's basically a whole working cattle ranch, Buck Island Ranch. It's 11,000 acres. And so we actually lived out on the ranch in kind of a sugar shack out there. And so I did my intern research on the ranch, doing ranch land ecology, and really fell in love with, you know, the idea of grasslands and pasture at large scales and how to think about managing them. Got really interested in some of the really alternative theories, like from the Alan Savory world in terms of grazing management. And then it is just kind of like a long path that ended up circling back to that stuff. We went back up north for a little while, and then in 2012, decided to pull the trigger and come back to grad school, and kind of fortuitously got set up with my advisor, Luke Flory, here in the agronomy department. And so then I'm kind of like the guy who came here to do a PhD and then never left.
I feel that. So I'll say I'm impressed by your, you know, you talk about your three topic areas you look at. And it's in my world, you know, so I'm soil fertility, extension specialist, though, so I get all things. But typically you don't see a lot of folks out there that play in both what I would say is the row crop production, agricultural production, and rangeland, which I do because we've got a lot of range in Oklahoma, a lot of pasture, and I'm also working with irrigated corn, so I get the realm. And it looks like you're really integrating all of Florida, right? At least based upon kind of your University of Florida webpage.
Yeah, I would say my core research area is definitely mostly in forages. And, you know, well, I think of that broadly, like, you know, I recently collaborated with some folks at Colorado State to publish a grazing management review paper. And they're more rangeland people. And so I feel very comfortable and interested in rangeland as well as pasture. I have a little bit of like personal experience with crops, but primarily in the kind of the mixed organic vegetable production models. So I feel pretty confident in that area. My large scale row crop stuff is more indirect. And so I don't necessarily claim that as a, you know, full area of expertise. But I sort of know enough about it to kind of teach our survey courses and give some perspective that way. But our work on, so I had a student do work on peanut physiology and pathogen interactions with drought stress a few years back. Those were greenhouse studies. So yeah, kind of, that's the beauty of ecology is we kind of rightly or not can sort of insert ourselves into a lot of different systems.
Exactly how I feel about fertility, right? I mean, most plants need nutrients of some kind, so I can kind of play around about anything I want to because plants require some level of nutrition, whether it's native or not. So share with us, you know, talk a little bit about some of your ongoing projects. What are you and your program working on right now?
Yeah. So I've got a couple angles that I'm excited about. I have a ongoing work in the area of remote sensing. So one of my recently graduated PhD students spent some time developing a model based on a European Space Agency satellite called Sentinel-2. And we use to predict kind of forage biomass and quality. And the beauty of these satellite platforms is the data are freely available. They give you large spatial coverage, decent temporal coverage. The next steps in that is in my stuff I've been working on kind of in the back burner for years now is combining those data with process-based models. And so we can really look at the fundamentals of how these ecosystems intercept light and convert that into biomass and use that as a way to generate this understanding at this larger scale that can hopefully help both inform management decisions as well as plug into some of the ecosystem service discussion and outcome models. So what are the impacts on the carbon cycle, the water cycle, you know, for watershed recharge and all that stuff. And so I see a need for models that can kind of sit in the middle of those use cases and then be informed by this, you know, widely available, extensible data. And so that's one of my areas of interest. And we got a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. But you know, I have actually a majority teaching appointment.
Yeah. Okay.
So
yeah.
Sometimes my research interests take a little bit of a backseat to some other stuff.
So let's jump into a little bit on your teaching hat, put your teaching hat on. Can you give kind of a brief description when you talk about process-based models, right? What's a process-based model versus, you know,
right,
other models we hear discussed quite a bit by academics?
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of different ways that you can try to use data to understand and predict the world. And so you can kind of do, you know, more black box type stuff. So, you know, all this whole area of AI is really making it into the news a lot. And that's basically an umbrella term for a set of what we call machine learning models. So things like neural networks, stuff like that. And those could work really, really well for generating predictions in certain contexts, like in image analysis. It's amazing what can be done, as well as, like, you know, audio, voice processing, all that kind of stuff. But they don't give you like a scientific picture of the world, right? And it's not at least directly helping you take a scientific theory for how the world works and confront it with data. So that's the type of modeling that I have more interest and experience in is, okay, so in the instance of plant growth, right, we know it's all driven by photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. We've got the fundamentals of photosynthesis and respiration. How do we parse, like, as simply as possible, represent those in a model and then collect whatever data are available to help us understand those processes? And there are ways that you can then use statistics to help guide that process. So without trying to get into a whole seminar on that, that would be kind of my high level loss.
No. And I think that's perfect because I'm myself much more of a process. My brain works better with a process based where I know I have my inputs. I know I have my outputs. And I get computer learning. I utilize machine learning and all that stuff and the decision trees and the retry, the retry, the retry. Yeah. But in the end, you know, get an output. And I always ask the students working with machine learning, it's like, okay, so what were the inputs to get this output? Right. And that's often a challenge when it comes to machine learning. I love mass balance, you know, that I have input and I have output. And that for me is much more logical. So I think that's a great description because in another podcast I just recorded, we did go into some of the AI and machine learning. So I'm happy to have somebody on the other side also talking about now more of a process-based approach.
And I should say, you know, I have really good colleagues that work in machine learning, you know, here at the University of Florida and elsewhere. And we do kind of have a long-range vision of sort of thinking about how do we hybridize these approaches. So take what machine learning can do well that the type of statistics that I do maybe can't do as well or as scalably and then put them together. But that's kind of like the bleeding edge frontier of science right now.
It really is. That's exciting. Tell us, you know, a lot of our listeners, we've kind of got a broad geography. We've got a fair amount of crop, but we also have a lot of forage producers and a lot of in the region of pasture, forage, and rangeland. So discuss a little bit about some of your ongoing work there. I'm looking at your number two, at least as far as the your bio goes and the, you know, the impact of nutrient application and grazing on basically root and shoot growth, I guess is how I'd break it down by the description.
Yeah. So I think taking a step back, I think one of the big ecosystem issues that is also highly in the press lately and on everybody's mind has to do with the carbon cycle. Mm-hmm. So we know, like, you know, with climate change, you know, the role that CO2 and methane play in that atmosphere. And so there's a ton of interest in, like, okay, hey, can we do land management practices that can help us mitigate climate change? And basically that means taking carbon out of the atmosphere and getting it into the soil in some form in which we have a reasonable basis to expect it to be there for long enough to matter. And that's typically a scale minimum of several decades, but ideally centuries to millennia. So to understand that, then we have to kind of understand all of these processes of how carbon gets into the soil and gets transformed and how does that interact with the ecophysiology of the plants, the microbial composition of the soil, the mineralogy of the soil, soil fertility, all these factors kind of integrate together to shape that. As well, you know, we've got a lot, we've got some real unknowns that are almost more like geology questions. So one of my kind of hobby horse things is pointing out how little we know about all of the carbon that moves down the soil profile and dissolved or particulate form for that matter. I think in our soil, our coarse textured soils here in Florida, it may actually be a pretty decent sized flux. And so we need, you know, a lot more study of that. So that's, I think, the kind of the broad ecosystem setting there. So, but the problem is now we've got the situation where we've got a lot of actors that have moved into the space of carbon credits and trying to quantify this in a way that, you know, could potentially pay people to adopt different practices. The theory is sound. The implementation is a lot harder than anybody would like it to be. And it may be fatally flawed. We don't know yet. And so one of my concerns, I think it's shared when I talk to colleagues from a variety of disciplines and kind of all over the map, is that it's feeling that a train has left the station prematurely. And so what do we need to do as ecosystem people to kind of play catch up and at least try to shape where this thing goes so that we don't have another disaster? Because I think it's a disservice to the public if we do something prematurely. It's a disservice to farmers who sign up for contracts that then turn out not to work, or they get pulled, which we've seen some high profile examples of that because the verification standards didn't work, basically. Nope. So anyway, we could talk for hours about that whole topic, but that's kind of one of my interests. And so that's an area where I see needing to pull together theory and models and data and additional experiments. If you want, I can go into a couple of the field experiments we've got going on right now here in Florida.
Yeah, so I'm just going to add on, and then we'll get into that. That's good. It's like, you know, we had an opportunity in Oklahoma probably 15 years ago to look at carbon validation, because there was a cycle where we thought we're going to have a carbon market about 15 years ago, and I was a young prof then, and so me and our soil water conservation specialist, we really started looking at, it wasn't anything about how to build carbon. It's just, could we actually measure it accurately over space and time? And we had some pretty solid results that said, that's hard, right? And so then it comes back and cycles back in. Like often things do, they kind of end up on a cyclical manner. And I'm with you that there's a lot of stuff that got pushed really quickly. And the validation side in its own, and just understanding long-term impacts. If we look at carbon cycling in itself, there was a lot of assumptions made a couple of years ago. I think we're learning that probably were, in theory or in hope, really cool sounding, but in practice, may not have been everything that it was led to be.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area intellectually, but I do get the urgency. Like we are seeing we're in the middle of what's, you know, a huge anomaly in sea surface and global land temperatures. We're fixing to have maybe one of the worst hurricane seasons on record. Acutely aware of that being here in Florida.
Yes.
of course, we don't know until the season actually happens. But the conditions, like, the table has been laid for that.
Yeah.
So I get the urgency and I feel it myself. But there's a real risk of almost like these kind of perverse outcomes if we do this wrong. So one thing we could say for sure, and without naming names, you know, of specific certifying groups or whatever, it's widely, you know, some of the major certifiers are trying to get away with, you know, sometimes, you know, they'll say three soil samples is enough to validate, or they'll just run a implementation of the century model itself and say, we don't even need data. And I can guarantee you with 100% confidence, that is incorrect.
And I will back you up 110%.
So anyone listening to this who's wondering, like, are we there yet with the accuracy of our models? The answer is no. And we can move on from there. The problem is we need to get to the point where the effort spent in sampling and mapping doesn't cost more than the value of the credits.
That's the real catch right now is that right there, the cost of and what we get from it. So before we're completely out of time, let's go a little bit more about, you know, what you're doing. So you mentioned some of the work you have in place right now. Let's hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we've looked at some this is myself and actually a lot of my colleagues here at the University of Florida and in our department had a longstanding interest in how, you know, diversifying pastures. A big example in Florida that's kind of, I think, a success story is development of different cultivars of perennial peanut or rhizoma peanut that can play well with our C4 warm season forages and form kind of permanent, relatively durable associations. So a few years, you know, back, the question then became, okay, what is the impact on this for soil fertility and for soil organic matter? Do we get additional accumulation of organic matter when we've diversified by adding legumes? So I've got a long-term plot experiment. We haven't published the data yet. I've got a master's student who's, this will be their thesis, is kind of the ecosystem stock comparisons where we've got peanut introduction. We've got it layered with some defoliation treatments to try to get at least some of these real life components of grazing or haying, and then a nutrient addition split to kind of look at the, how nutrient limitation is impacting both forage production and quality, as well as potentially the organic matter in the soil. And I have to say, so far, without stealing all of our thunder, the results are a little deflationary. We don't see nearly as strong treatment signatures as at least I was expecting, you know, and some of our treatments have been in place getting to be 7-8 years now. So we'll have more on that coming up. Another area we're looking at is trying to get at these climate stresses. So good friend, colleague now, Bill Hammond, joined our department a couple of years back. He's a real star in stress physiology. So he's, I think his Twitter handle is "What Kills Trees," something like that. And so he's done some really excellent work on the physiology of, you know, plant stress and death and mortality under climate stress. And so reading one of his papers made me aware of this platform called TerraClimate that you can use to kind of conveniently pull climate change. It's basically an ensemble of climate models of predictions for how it's going to impact weather at individual sites.
Okay.
So I pulled up our experimental site, ran it through the TerraClimate platform, and basically got, okay, here's the last 30-year weather pattern, and then it will tell you, okay, let's layer 2C or a 4C scenario on top of it. Let's look at temperature, evaporative demand, all these really important factors. And I can tell you that the under the higher end climate scenario, the what we call the VPD, the vapor pressure deficit, basically that amount of drying, baking pressure goes haywire. And so that motivated me to set up, I got some seed funding to put up a rainfall exclusion study to basically remove precipitation from, we put out 2x2 meter exclusion shelters basically, and then nested inside that actually a nutrient rate study. The reasons for that are a little complicated, but you'll appreciate it. So we go everywhere from no nutrient application up to twice the IFAS recommended rate for hay production. So we've got 0, 1/2x, 1x, and 2x. And it's kind of cool to see like those beautiful curves of production and quality responses to nutrients. But this is also enabling us to try to get at, okay, how do these factors, how does nutrient enrichment interact with a drought stress?
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've also learned that like methodologically, these studies are a little challenging with our perennial grasses because they have these deep, beautiful root systems that go all the way down into the soil water table. So we see an effect of that rainfall exclusion. It's not nearly as big as one would think. So I'm actually working on like getting together a grant proposal that would get us funding to do a full, like maybe even like tile drainage system.
Oh yeah.
To where we could maybe drop the water table and really simulate what would happen with like a spring like we've been having now, but add additional warming on top of it and say the whole regional water table is going down, you know, X number of centimeters. What is our impact on the soil processes and microbial processes, plant processes? As a sneak preview, one of my PhD students has gotten some really exciting results looking at sequencing of the microbial communities taken from the surface soil, which is really impacted by our manipulation. And it's pretty profound how that shapes microbial communities. So that's kind of the stuff that we're working on, where we can look at both the production side, the quality side, soil response side, layering in these climate stressors. I'd love to also do passive warming manipulations, things like that, and really get a better picture of how are these systems going to respond, you know, in these climate scenarios.
Well, Chris, that's, you've got a lot of really cool work going on, and I kind of want to touch base with you like a year or two from now when you've got some of this stuff. And I understand the teaching role. So just before, what's your split teaching research?
Yeah, we do percentages at UF. That's probably similar. I don't know if that's a land grant thing or, but I'm 60% teaching, 40% research.
Oh, bless your heart, as they would say in the Midwest. So I hired on as a 70-30 extension teaching, and now I'm a 55-30-15 extension teaching research. So I got a three-way split.
You're one of those with a three-way.
Yeah. And so I know what a 30% teaching appointment is. So I also know what a 60% would be. And again, bless your heart, because it is something that most people don't understand, is that teaching is extremely rewarding and extremely exhausting. All at the same time. It is takes a lot of energy to do that on a daily basis, to keep a bunch of college kids involved in a lecture hall 3 days, 2 days a week.
Right.
So I appreciate your work there.
It's time for our famous three.
Are you ready to maximize your acres? Discover KWS Hybrid Rye, the high-yielding rye with Pollen Plus technology. Designed for superior growth and resilience, KWS Hybrid Rye helps you achieve greater productivity and profitability. Don't miss out on this innovative solution for your fields. Visit KWS.com today to learn more about how KWS Hybrid Rye can transform your farming practices. KWS Hybrid Rye, growing innovation for your future.
We're going to move on to the final three questions that I ask all my guests. And so the first is, you know, what's a go-to work resource? When you come up to a stumbling block, where do you go?
That is a really great question. And I imagine you could go a lot of directions with it. I'll relate a recent experience I had. So related to that rainfall exclusion study, my biological scientist and who's also working on her master's degree, she informed me, okay, we've got some really weird damage to our shelters and yada, yada. So then I went out in the field to help her out, and just being out there and making observations in person stimulated several like new ideas. And I was like, man, this is why I can't afford to become one of those people who never gets out of the office.
Yeah.
So I'd say going outside is my biggest go-to resource. It's either that or get some exercise. Clear in the head.
No, I love it. I think as we were just talking earlier in my office, that there's a lot of value for you know, us as academics to get out in the field, you know, be talking, be seen, and just the stuff I see on a tractor or combine really gets me. I guess you'd say get the juices flowing and really kicks up new ideas and new concepts. And if I never left my office and all I did was lecture and that, I don't know how I could. You know what I'd be doing now, but it wouldn't be the same thing. In all the free time you have, because you know you're not trying to get tenure or anything. What do you do for leisure activities?
Well, it really enjoys. So I've got a 4-year-old. So we enjoy trying to, you know, get out and hikes or other fun adventures with the family. And just like my purely personal hobby lately has been actually jiu-jitsu. So I've caught the grappling bug. So I try to get on the mats a couple times a week now.
So. That's awesome. Finally, if somebody wants to know more about your program and everything, where would they go to find out some more information about your research?
So I think the department webpage is not terrible. Mm-hmm. I have another website, agrosystem-ecology.com. That is sorely in need of an update. And so you're asking me this question has further serve to underline that should advance up my priority list, because it basically has all my first wave of graduate students, and we've had a whole turnover since then. But it does give a sense of kind of like what my priorities and goals are, at least. So I can send that along to you if you want to put that in the show notes or.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining. Again, we have Dr. Chris Wilson, the associate assistant. I almost gave you a promotion there. Assistant professor, Forges, global.
Packets out for review, so maybe in a year.
Fantastic. That's always, at least the package is out. That's hugely helpful. But he's at the University of Florida. And folks, if you enjoyed this podcast, what you heard, make sure you hit that subscribe button so you get notifications on when we have a new one. If you have any questions or any suggestions for new guests, make sure that you share it with us and let us know. Again, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure having you on. And I look forward to watching your career as you keep going forward. You're doing a lot of fun things.
Well, thanks very much, Brian. I enjoyed coming on and talking to you and a chance to talk to your audience, too.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.